But for this week, I want to welcome back Kate Hawks. 2 weeks ago, she shared with us about Christianity versus slavery. And tonight, she's going to talk to us about what Christians think and believe about women over the years without it being misconstrued the way it so many times is and some of the myths that we hear in our society. She's going to take those head on. But I want to introduce Kate. Kate grew up at Hill Country Bible Church, where her father, Tim, serves as lead pastor. She has a degree from Southern Methodist University, and she received the Richter Fellowship to study the role of public discourse and religion in London. Through that experience, she was able to interview over 45 world-renowned Christian, Muslim, and secular leaders. She further pursued study in the sociology and anthropology of religion in contemporary society, earning a master's from King's College in London, and she also studied apologetics at LaBrie International. She spent 2 years in London doing nonprofit work, and now she works in the tech industry here in Austin and has prepared something special for us tonight. Without further ado, I want to welcome Kate Hawks.
Thank you. So tonight we're going to talk about the historic relationship between Christianity and women. And before jumping in, I want to talk a little bit about what we're not going to talk about tonight. So this isn't church, like we've said kind of throughout the lecture series. I'm not going to be talking about the Bible and what the Bible says about women. Not really going to be discussing women's role in the church and kind of that whole topic. This is going to be a look at history and kind of a historical overview of this relationship. I'm also not really going to touch on, you know, there are a lot of kind of very emotive, sensitive subjects around women's rights, especially in contemporary times, and those are really important, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room have strong opinions about that and have personal experiences with different ones of these topics, and that's also not really what this talk is going to be about. So I'm going to be looking at a high level kind of look at history and try to think through whether or not our common perception of the church's historic relationship with women is actually accurate. So to jump in, let's look at the myth. The myth that I've identified is that Christianity historically relegated women to a low status in society, opposing women's rights and freedoms. The church is the ultimate symbol of patriarchy, misogyny, and bigotry. So in other words, the myth is that the Bible puts the blame on Eve as a woman for bringing sin into the human race. So women are seen as morally inferior and must be kept in their place so that they don't mess everything up. So the truth is that misogyny and patriarchy has been the norm throughout most of history and most cultures, really through all of history and all cultures, and the Christian church has been guilty of this as well. But is the statement that the church has always been against women and has always seen women in this light actually accurate? Throughout this lecture, I'm going to look at three main areas of history to kind of help us think through this and whether or not this myth is true. So I'm going to give you the three topics, and then we'll jump in. So the first one is going to be the early church and its context. The second one is the Christian view of the flesh and the female. And the third one is the church as the oppressor in the medieval witch hunts. So let's jump into the first topic, the early church in context. So the reason I want to look at this is to kind of give us an idea of what the ancient culture saw women's role to be and how they viewed women at the time that the early church was born. So in the ancient Greco-Roman world, women were seen as both morally and physically inferior to men and had a very, very low social standing. If we look at the Greek poets, they summed it up very well, the kind of popular attitude towards women. Euripides said, "Why hast thou given a home beneath the sun, Zeus, unto woman, specious curse to man?" Aeschylus said, "Evil of mind are they, women, and guileful of purpose, with impure hearts." And Aristophanes said, "For women are a shameless sect, the vilest of creatures going." Ouch. So in ancient Athens, women were not allowed to leave the home without a male escort, and if men were in their home as a dinner guest or something like that, they weren't allowed to actually interact with them. In Roman law, there was a law called Manus, which gave the husband absolute control over life and death over his wife, and also husbands had the ability to punish or chastise their wives. There was also a law in Rome called Patria Potestas, which gave the man supreme power over his wife and his children, and he could execute them at any time if he deemed it necessary. Women's lives in the ancient world were cheap, and they were viewed as property rather than people without a lot of value. Female infanticide was a legal, morally acceptable, and widely practiced thing that was going on in all kind of social classes. There were far more female children born than were actually allowed to live. Drowning and exposure of female infants was very common, and it was seen as reasonable, just normal. Both Plato and Aristotle recommended infanticide as legitimate state policy. There was also a widespread practice of abortion in classical times, and because of the way that they practiced abortion, this caused a lot of death among women. So one of the ways that women would try to abort their fetuses was by taking poison, just enough so that it wasn't lethal for the mother, but that it would kill the fetus. So oftentimes the mother would die as well, because it was very difficult to tell how much poison you should take. There were also manual ways of trying to abort children. So long needles, hooks, and knives were used, and this also caused death of a lot of women. So why would they do it? Some women did it because they wanted to hide infidelity. If a woman was unfaithful to her husband or was seen as sexually promiscuous in that culture, she would be ostracized or punished, so she wanted to hide that. Other times women did it because of poverty, trying to kind of just escape the circumstances that they were in. But then also, interestingly, men, husbands, had the power to tell their wives that they had to abort once they found out that they were pregnant. This was apparently common enough that there was a law about this. There was a Roman law that discouraged men from commanding their wives to abort for unnecessary reasons. You needed to have a good reason. Marriage in the ancient cultures was also held in very low esteem in the very male-dominated Greco-Roman world. A Roman censor in 131 BCE proposed that the Senate actually make marriage compulsory because so many men preferred to stay single. Men tended to be very promiscuous, while virginity was demanded of women. Wives also were not allowed to divorce their husbands, whereas husbands could kick their wives to the curb at any point. So in the midst of this society and culture, where women were very deprived of basic rights and were viewed as inferior to men morally and physically and intellectually, the Christian view of women and women's treatment in Christian communities was drastically different and revolutionary. Women had a far higher status within the church and in the Christian community than anywhere else in the ancient world. This was because of the Christian doctrine that said that women were equal to men and bore the image of God. So women were seen to have inherent value, and they were seen as valuable both to the church and valuable to the society. Christian doctrine prohibited abortion and infanticide. They condemned those practices as murder. And because of that, there was a higher number of Christian women in the Christian communities. Christianity also sanctified the marital bond and provided women with far better marital security and equality. Church doctrine condemned divorce, incest, marital infidelity, and polygamy, and stressed the obligation of both wives and husbands towards each other. They valued chastity and faithfulness both between the husband and the wife, whereas in the pagan cultures, there was more of a double standard where men could be promiscuous, and that was morally and socially acceptable, and women were not allowed to do that. Both Christian men and women were urged to remain virgins until marriage, and fidelity without divorce was expected of both women and men. Christian women also married at an older age than their Greek and Roman counterparts. So the typical marrying age for Greek and Roman women was 11 to 13. Officially in the Roman Empire, 12 was the legal age, but there was really no teeth in that law. So girls that were given away to marriage before 12 kind of passed on without notice. And oftentimes marriages were consummated at the point of marriage. So these were young girls that were getting married. Whereas in the Christian communities, the age of marriage became later and later. Widows were also treated much better in Christian communities. They were respected, and they were allowed to keep their husband's estate if their husband passed away. They could choose whether to remarry, and the church was also commanded to take care of widows that were in poverty. Whereas pagan widows faced huge, huge social pressure to remarry right after their husbands passed away. Augustus, the emperor, actually passed a law that required women to remarry within 2 years, otherwise they'd be fined. And once women did remarry, they had to give up their dowry, their estate from their previous husband to their new husband. Polygamy was not really legal in the Greco-Roman world, but it was legal and widely practiced in surrounding cultures in the Middle East, and Christianity was very clear that monogamy was really the only suitable form of marriage, which also really heightened the status of women within the marriage relationship and gave them more value there and better treatment. Christianity was also exceptionally appealing to women, and women outnumbered men in the early Christian community. One historian estimates that there were about 60% women within the Christian community. Celsus, the second century pagan critic of Christianity, ridiculed the faith as vulgar and irrational because of its attraction of large numbers of women. Women were also very key in evangelizing and drawing converts and expanding the faith. One historian has said, "The work and zeal of faithful Christian women was a powerful force in the early church's spiritual and numerical growth and geographic expansion. As every church historian knows, women commonly were more active in the early church than were men. No survey of the evidence could leave one in any doubt that this was a religion to which women were powerfully drawn, and one that would not have spread nearly so far or so swiftly, but for the great number of women in its fold." In contrast to the surrounding culture, women also enjoyed positions of authority and leadership within the church. So just a couple of examples. Paul the Apostle wrote to the Romans about Phoebe, who he called a deacon. And there are other examples of early church fathers also referring to women as deacons. So this was seen as a common and normal thing for women to hold these positions of leadership and practice liturgical rites and kind of administer the ministries of the church. There were also women that held churches in their homes and were considered apostles and saints. There's consensus widely among historians that in early Christianity, women did hold positions of power and honor, and Roman persecutions also support this theory. So martyrs tended to be men, and they tended to be men of authority within the church, such as bishops. But there were also a surprisingly substantial number of women that were martyred as well, which has led historians to assume that those women were seen as important officials within the church by the Romans who were persecuting the church. Outside of the early church and the community, Christianity also had a positive impact at large in the Roman Empire. So there were many significant legal reforms by Christian emperors. One historian has said that the legal reforms instituted by a number of Christian emperors in their attempts to bring the law into closer conformity with the precepts of their faith betray a solicitude for the welfare and rights of women often absent from pagan legislation. So to give you a few examples, many of you are familiar with Constantine, the emperor. He passed reforms that eased the hardships of widows, and he also protected girls against marriage by abduction. Valentinian I, 50 years after Christianity became legal in the Roman Empire in 313 AD, repealed the 1,000-year-old Patria Potestas law, which we spoke about earlier, that had given husbands power of life and death over their families. He also gave them more property rights and provided women more guardianship over their children. So previously, men always had guardianship over their children, and now women had more equality in that and more say in that. Theodosius, who was famous for his legal code, included benefits for women in divorce and also freed girls from their father's authority if their fathers wanted to prostitute the girls. Interestingly, he also gave slave girls freedom if their masters abused them. Finally, Justinian, who was largely influenced by his wife Theodora, expanded the rights and protections of women in the empire to an altogether unprecedented degree. He passed laws even to protect prostitutes from exploitation. And he protected women from being forced into prostitution. If women were charged with crimes and were sent into prison, he passed laws that said that they had to be guarded by other women to prevent them from being abused within the prisons. So in conclusion, Christianity in its truest and earliest form really showed a dramatic and radical shift from the status of women in the ancient cultures. Women were seen as valuable in their essence as well as in their rights, and it really made a concrete difference in their day-to-day lives. Unfortunately, as time went on, the institutional church fathers did revert back to viewing women as inferior to men and even sinful. So that brings me to the next kind of part of history that I want to discuss tonight, which is the Christian view of the flesh and the female. So there's a popular conception throughout history and today that the Christian church despises the physical body or the flesh, that there's this idea of the separation from the body as sinful and fleshly, and then the soul as kind of higher or divine or rational. French feminist Simone de Beauvoir said, "The Christian is divided within himself. The separation of body and soul, of life and spirit, is complete. Original sin makes of the body the enemy of the soul. All ties of the flesh seem evil." Now, throughout history, women have suffered the most from this dualism, as the female and the female body is supposed to be particularly despised as impure and a source of temptation, and the female is associated with the body, while men are associated with the soul or the spirit. Lori Cabot, a famous American witchcraft high priestess, says, "Official church doctrine preached that women was the source of all evil, since Eve trafficked with the serpent, and that sex and the body were dirty and vile." So Christianity is seen to posture women as the daughters of Eve, the cause of the fall and original sin, and by nature they are evil and wicked and licentious. So let's look at a couple of the church fathers and what they were saying about women. In the 3rd century AD, Tertullian, an early church father who actually coined the term Trinity, said, "And do you not know that you are each in Eve? The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You were the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man." St. Ambrose said, "Remember that God took the rib out of Adam's body, not a part of his soul, to make her, Eve. She was not made in the image of God like man." So that's a real clear distinction between body and soul. And Eve, or woman, comes from the body, whereas Adam comes from the soul. And then finally, St. Jerome said, "Woman is the root of all evil." Cool. So actually, this idea of the denigration of the body and the split between body and soul, and then the subsequent association of women with the body, is just completely a heresy or a twisting of original Christian doctrine. So if we look at the history of Christianity and church tradition on this topic, what we actually see is the reverse. We see an affirmation of the physical body. Christianity is unique in the religions of the world and in the ideologies in its doctrine of the incarnation, which literally means embodied in flesh or taking on flesh by the divine. Central to the faith is the belief in resurrection of the physical body, not just of Christ's body, but also of the bodies of the believers of the end times. And then we also see the teaching of the coming of the new heaven and the new physical earth. Additionally, the Christian church teaches that the physical body is actually the temple of the Holy Spirit. So where did this idea come from, that the body and the soul are separate and that women equal the body and equal bad? This dualism actually originated in Greek thought and was later incorporated by church fathers. So it was the Greek philosophers that drew a clear distinction between the body and the soul and valued the soul over the body. If we look at Plato, he believed that the soul was first created, then it was embodied, and he believed that there was always a tension between soul and body, and that actually the soul was imprisoned by the body and was not able to truly perceive the world while it was imprisoned by the body. He said, "If we would have true knowledge of anything, we must be quit of the body. Purification is the release of the soul from the chains of the body." So in Greek philosophy, he saw the soul as good and rational, and he associated that with men, while the carnal, lustful, and inferior flesh came to be associated with women. And this comes out in Plato's thought. He clearly saw man as the superior sex. As evidenced in his view of reincarnation, he said, "He who lived well during his appointed time was to return and dwell in his native star, and there he would have a blessed and congenial existence. But if he failed in attaining this, at the second birth, he would pass into a woman." So in Plato's thought, once you die, your soul separates from your body and goes to your native star if you're good. And if not, then you're reincarnated to a physical form again, which is considered lowly, and even lower than that, a form of a woman. Aristotle, Plato's pupil, associated women with the realm of matter, body, and imperfection, while associating men with spirit, soul, and the divine. He's very famous for developing the idea of rationality, which he associated with men only. Men were rational animals. Women were neither rational nor civilized. He said, "For the female is, as it were, a mutilated male. For there is only one thing they have not in them, the principle of soul." These ideas and associations are familiar, but they're often wrongly attributed to the Bible. You might be thinking, wait, in the Bible, there is a lot of talk about the flesh versus the spirit, and there is, but we're so accustomed to this Greek dualism between the body and the soul that we we put this meaning into the flesh and the spirit that we see in the body that's actually not there. So actually in the Bible, when it's talking about that, the Christian tradition is talking about the flesh in terms of human nature, and it's distinguishing between humans versus the divine. So the contrast is between humanity and God, not body and soul, and there's certainly not a denigration there of the body itself, and certainly not one of women. Very sadly, the Greek view of dualism between body and soul and its implications for the perception of men versus women began to infiltrate the church, and these views heavily influenced very famous church theologians and thinkers, such as Augustine and Aquinas. Augustine believed that women's image of God was inferior to that of the man. And Thomas Aquinas, who is a very famous scholastic theologian known for his attempt to synthesize Greek thought with Christianity, said, "As regards the individual nature, woman is defective and misbegotten, for the active force in the male seed tends to the production of a perfect likeness in the masculine sex, while the production of woman comes from defect in the active force or from some material indisposition." We can also see this dualism and misogyny playing out throughout the medieval period, a time that is well known and often portrayed as hateful of the sinful flesh. We see unhealthy sexuality there and asceticism. Now, an important point is that although theologically the church was regressing in its views on women, the status of women actually wasn't regressing back to how it was in ancient times. However, because the theology was bad in these early church fathers and then throughout the medieval periods and beyond, there's a myth that's been propagated that they were also treating women badly. So an example of that myth is that of Eve's curse. So we know in Genesis, God told Adam and Eve that because of the fall, because of sin, women would from then on experience pain in childbirth. So the myth says that in the 1800s, when anesthesia for childbirth was presented, that the church was actually opposed to that because they believed that women should experience pain in childbirth and that God intended that. However, historical research of both medical and religious sources of the period have shown that this was just not true. Religious opposition to anesthesia was essentially non-existent. Now, there was some opposition to it, but it was from other sources, including medical and physiological sources. Additionally, an important point to recognize is that one of the things that sparked the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century was that the church was getting too far away from the Bible and the early teachings and kind of off into philosophy, which also included the Greek philosophers' thinking. So the Reformation led to a formal theological rejection of this idea of the split between the body and the soul, and it paved the way for reforms later on down the road. And there are also some glowing examples of women during this time who were theologians, thinkers, and contributors to church thought, and I don't have time to talk through all of them now, but I could recommend some sources if you guys are interested. But women were doing things in the church and were holding prominent places in church history. As the Protestant Reformation was correcting the underpinnings of some of the views towards women, the Enlightenment thinkers, who were promoting a turn away from religion in favor of science and natural law, were going back to the ancient Greek and Roman thinking. Now, I want to be honest with you. At this point, I can't really point to clear examples of how the Protestant Reformation immediately changed women's status for the better. That was a very slow and long road, and slower than it should have been. But the Enlightenment thinkers were not doing anything for women either. So during the Enlightenment, when we were supposedly liberated from church oppression and superstition, Enlightenment thinkers such as Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and others promoted equality and democratic principles, but only for people of their own gender and people of their own race. They classified women as being inferior to men on the basis of the laws of nature. They were just innately inferior. One historian said, "Even though misogyny, the hatred of women, is based on irrational magical thinking, it persisted in Europe into and beyond the Enlightenment, when rationality and science were emphasized. In Charles Darwin's evolutionary theory of natural selection and Herbert Spencer's philosophy of the survival of the fittest, women were seen as emotional, less rational, and passive, as well as physically weaker and hence inferior to men. Women's skills and brains were smaller than men's, and this was taken as proof that women were less intelligent. Evolutionary theory was used to justify the cultural bias against women." And then I just want to give you another quote from another prominent thinker at that time, Hegel. He said, "Women may well be educated, but they are not made for the higher sciences, for philosophy and certain artistic productions, which require a universal element. Women may have insights, taste, and delicacy, but they do not possess the ideal. The difference between man and woman is the difference between animal and plant. When men are in charge of government, the state is in danger, for their actions are based not on the demands of universality, but on the contingent inclination and opinion. So there you go. I won't comment more on that. Let's go to the next kind of section of history that I want to look at to help us think through this myth. So this is the church as the oppressor in the medieval witch hunts. So we're all pretty familiar with this story. The story goes that in 16th and 17th century Europe and North America, millions of women were tortured by the church into confessing non-existent crimes and then burnt at the stake for witchcraft. The villain of the story is very familiar. It is the church. In Catholic countries, it was the Inquisition, and in Protestant countries, it was radical Puritanism. Rationalist Enlightenment historians who came after the supposed witch craze classified it as a result of religious fanaticism and intolerance, and feminism have looked at it as just another historical example of the church's oppression and demonization of women. Carl Sagan said, during the European witch craze, if you're accused of witchcraft, you're a witch. Torture is an unfailing means to demonstrate the validity of the accusations. There are no rights of the defendant. With the Pope's encouragement guaranteed, inquisitors began springing up all over Europe. The story of the witch hunts has been powerful in positioning the church as an institution against women in the modern Western mind. However, recent historians have started to call into question this story, especially specific components of it. So I'm going to kind of walk through a couple different core components of the story that now are not so solid in historians' minds. The first is about the frequency of witches themselves during this period. So the idea is that in the 16th and 17th centuries, the frequency of witchcraft sprang up because of church oppression and repression, and then kind of trickled down after the 1700s when the Enlightenment period started to liberate everybody because of science and rational thought. But actually, as historians have looked more into it, they're starting to question the sources. So during the 1600s and 1700s, there was more routinization of the judicial courts, and we have more records of the trials themselves. Before that, there weren't really records. Trials were taking place more kind of at an ad hoc basis in villages and more informal locations. And we just don't have those records. So the fact that we don't have records before and that we do have records during the witch craze doesn't mean that there was an increase in the number of witches or trials. So it's irresponsible history to say that something happened that we're not sure happened. Additionally, after the 17th century and the 18th century, when the witch craze started to die down, supposedly, historians have actually said that there were lynchings and beatings of witches continuing on into the 19th century. But they weren't officially sanctioned by judicial or church authorities, so we just don't count them. So this idea that there was this huge craze is actually really maybe not true. Second, historians have called into question the identity of the story's famous villain, the church. According to the story, the Inquisition, priests, and Puritans were hunting down women right and left to torture and execute them for witchcraft. The truth is, based on recent research, that rather than instigating witch hunts, the church often had a moderating effect on them. So most of the prosecutions were actually not about heresy or communion with the devil. Instead, they were about typical superstitions and tensions within villages. So at this point, understanding the world through magic was very common. If misfortune happened or problems happened, if someone's stuff was stolen or if someone got sick or if someone's crops failed, people would understand that and explain that oftentimes through magic and accuse other people in the village of causing that. So in fact, most of the prosecutions were lay rather than religious, and there were a great number that were prosecuted by women. Even more women brought prosecutions than men did. Additionally, the romanticized picture of cruel Catholic inquisitors has waned in popularity with scholars as the role of secular authorities and lay accusations has become more prominent. Historian William Monteir said the mildness of inquisitorial judgments on witchcraft contrasts strikingly with the severity of secular judges throughout Northern Europe. Indeed, most secular European legal systems punish their prisoners more severely than the Inquisition. The execution rate in Italy and Spain, where the Inquisition actually was lower than anywhere else in Europe. And this was because of the higher standards of truth that they demanded. In the prosecutions, the Inquisition demanded evidence, and they demanded thorough investigations into the accusations. And they were also suspicious of any kind of fanatical charges. One historian even said that far from encouraging prosecutions, the Spanish Inquisition protected women from charges of witchcraft. Another famous villain in the story, in addition to the Inquisition, was American Puritanism. The infamous witch trials of Salem, Massachusetts in the late 17th century is the prime example of American Puritan persecution of women. I don't really have time today to walk through the intricacies of the Salem witch trials and the various theories, but we do know that most people in this room in school were required to read The Crucible, probably in high school. And so there was this idea that we all had growing up that there were witch trials, like the Salem witch trials, happening all over the place in Puritan North America. And that just wasn't true. Actually, historian Philip Sampson says the Salem events have become notorious not because they were typical, but because they were exceptional in their time. Far from witchcraft trials being rife among Puritan communities, the Salem trials were pretty much the extent of it. Also on the Protestant side, John Calvin, who is second only to Martin Luther in influencing the Protestant Reformation, has often been portrayed as a zealous witch hunter. Actually, he didn't even believe in witchcraft. He didn't see it in the Bible, so he thought it didn't exist. And in his mind, the solution to any problem was not execution, it was the gospel. Like the Inquisition, Protestant churches were far less enthusiastic about witch hunts than is popularly portrayed, and they required assessment of accusations and evidence and encouraged restraint in the secular courts. There's also a question about numbers. So in the story, millions of people were being killed, millions of women were being killed all over Europe for this 300-year period. But actually, as people have looked more into it and historians have really critically viewed the primary sources, they've begun to think that that's just not true. So one historian, Michelet, kind of promoting the myth, said that if the state had not restrained the worthy bishops involved, they would have burnt all their subjects. The witch trials and executions have been compared to the Holocaust or a genocide, and historians have claimed that slaughter on this scale happened in every European country for centuries. Actually, the execution rates varied by country and were lowest in Italy and Spain, like I mentioned before, where the Inquisition actually took place. The majority of villages and towns didn't even experience a single trial throughout the whole 300 years. Some more recent estimates about the number of executions by historians were that between 40,000 and 60,000 executions happened over the 300-year period. Now, these would have happened for various different reasons that we don't have time to get into, and we certainly view any kind of death, especially at that scale, as a huge human tragedy, so this is not to downplay it. But if we look at the Enlightenment historians that kind of came up with this myth, and if we look at what the underpinnings of their philosophies led to in the 20th century, where we see the millions of deaths caused by fascist and socialist philosophies, it really puts into perspective the 40,000 witches that were supposedly burnt versus millions and millions of people that were killed in a short time. So it's not to downplay that, but just to kind of show the power of the myth and our thinking about what the church has done or not done compared to what other philosophies have done. Historians have also put the issue of torture into perspective. So torture did happen in these witch trials, but it wasn't just the church that was doing this. The background for the use of torture was its use in criminal proceedings generally, and the Inquisition was actually more moderate in its use of torture, and it was skeptical about the validity of confessions obtained by torture. So this was the modern story of witchcraft and the witch craze. This was put forward by the rationalist historians, positioning the church against science and against women. But there's also a postmodern story of the witch craze. Feminist witchcraft scholar Diane Perkis tells the story well. She says, once upon a time, there was a woman who lived alone in her house surrounded by her garden, in which she grew all manner of herbs and other healing plants. The woman was a healer and a midwife. She had mystical knowledge derived from her closeness to nature or from a half-submerged pagan religion. She helped women give birth, and she had healing hands. However, even though this woman was harmless, she posed a threat to the fearful. Her medical knowledge threatened the male doctor. Her simple, true spiritual values threatened the superstitious nonsense of the Catholic Church, as did her affirmation of the sensuous body. Her independence and freedom threatened men. So the Inquisition descended on her and cruelly tortured her into confessing lies about the devil. She was burned alive by men who hated women, along with millions of others just like her. Now, this story is similar to the modern story in that it shows women to be oppressed by the church, but it's a little bit more fitting to postmodern thinking in that it actually positions science and the church together against women. And science and the church are seen as male forms of control that are trying to exclude women and control women and their bodies. It also highlights New Age thinking and beliefs, which are very popular in our kind of postmodern age and fitting with the postmodern mindset. Perkis goes on, "Do you believe this story? Thousands of women do. It is still being retold by women who are academics, popular historians, theologians, and dramatists. It is compelling, even horrifying. However, in all essentials, it is not true, or only partly true, as a history of what happened to the women called witches in the early modern period." So Perkis in her book says that actually there's no evidence that these women who were persecuted were healers or midwives, or that they were sexually liberated, or were persecuted mostly by men. Links with pagan natural religion are very tenuous. She says that the Inquisition, like we discussed before, was tended to be more lenient than lay courts. Rather than historical fact, this is a story, a myth for our time. The story paints women as powerful, knowledgeable, and spiritually connected, while the male authorities try to maintain power over them and exclude them by wielding their scientific and religious authority. It legitimates the identification of oppression with a powerful institution above all Christianity. So I want to close with just a few thoughts. So it's clear we've seen throughout history, women have been oppressed. Women have been hated and seen as morally, physically, spiritually inferior to men. I've shown that this is by no means unique to Christianity, although Christianity has participated in it. We've seen that Enlightenment and classical thinkers have promoted this doctrine and that Christianity reprehensibly has accepted it as well. And it's been a really long road to seeing where women can actually participate in society and have equal rights and be viewed as valuable people. One thing that I do want to point out is that while the progress towards women's rights in the church was excruciatingly slow, slower than we'd like to see as Christians, progress in areas of the world where Christianity has had little to no influence has been way behind that. So I just want to mention a few practices that have been relatively recently outlawed in different parts of the world to kind of give more of a well-rounded idea of how women have been oppressed historically. So in Indian and Asian cultures, there's a practice called sati, which is a tradition of burning widows when their husbands pass away. And to give a little kind of color around this, oftentimes, especially when this was practiced, women were married to men when they were very young. And if their husbands passed away, these women were still young and were either voluntarily burned alive or forced by their brothers, their children, and their cultures. So this practice was outlawed by British authorities in India in 1829 during the colonial period, and there was actually a huge kind of backlash from the multiculturalist perspective saying that this was ruining Indian culture. This practice continued for a long time even after the ban, and as recently as 1988, there was passed the Indian Sati Prevention Act that tried to further criminalize any type of aiding, abetting, and glorifying of sati. And I read, many of you might have seen, there was a recent article in 1987, which was when I was born, of a young woman who voluntarily sacrificed herself as part of this widow burning because that was kind of honorable within the culture, and women have been dying from that. Another aspect that I want to talk about is Chinese foot binding, which also many of you will be familiar with. This is the practice where in the Chinese culture, women were seen to be more beautiful if their feet were smaller. So as children, as babies, their feet were bound so that the bones would break. And as they grew older, their feet stayed very small. And this caused lots of health complications for many women and was obviously very painful. This was outlawed in 1912, as recently as 1912, and the practice continued even into the 1920s. Another kind of type of persecution against women is female circumcision, which has been practiced in many cultures around the world and actually is still happening today. Another one is child brides, where women are given against their will as children to be married to men who they don't know. Now, this is not to place blame or point fingers at different cultures, but to just give a broader picture of the abuse against women that has been happening and is happening all around the world, and to shed some light on these abuses that are still carrying on today. Now, one thing I wanted to look at that I found interesting, this is a map from 2011 of the 20 best and 20 worst countries to live in for women. So these actually represent countries, these circles, and this is the 20 best countries to live in for women. and these are the worst. And this just shows, as much as Christianity has had a history of bad theology and bad thinking towards women, it has reformed, and the idea that women have inherent value and are worth something in God's eyes and are equal to men has trickled down and actually has made a difference in the world. And we see that countries heavily influenced by Christianity have actually become better and better and are the best places for women to live now. And countries that haven't had that influence, women are still really struggling for their rights today. So as a community, we need to be aware of this and kind of aware of the abuses against women in our day now and engage as much as possible in the conversation and doing what we can to stop that. Finally, I want to say a few things about kind of more contemporary issues of women's rights and speak especially to the women in the room. Now, there's a big perceived tension between the church today, I think, and women's rights, especially feminism. I think that's to an extent a result of what we've been talking about today, this myth about the historical church always being against women. But I also think it has something to do with feminism as we understand it today. But if we look at feminism historically, I think that we can understand it maybe a little bit differently. So if we look at first wave feminism, we know there are three waves of feminism. First wave feminism really predominantly focused on women's rights in terms of voting, the suffragettes, property rights, and also equal pay. And we're really all on board with that. I don't think that anyone would say that the church is against that. That's pretty much settled. And we don't really think about that when we're thinking about feminism today. Today, when we're talking about feminism and against the church, we're talking about the second and third wave feminists. So this has more to do with ideas of women's sexual liberation, reproductive rights, topics like abortion, or the deconstruction of gender completely, or sexuality as power for women. Around these topics, we tend to see the church occupying the opposite side of the debating table from feminism. And so we see the church butting heads with feminism in popular culture and in the news and in all types of discussion. And so we have an idea, I think, that the church is against women's rights. But I would like to propose that feminism and women's rights have been kind of conflated, maybe fallaciously. I think that feminism is presenting, there are many types of feminism, but radical feminism especially presents a viewpoint on topics of women's rights and an opinion about the most beneficial rights for women in society, but that's just a viewpoint that's not neutral. I think women's rights are a topic that everybody should be thinking about and engaging in, and the church also. Many churches have different ideas on different types of women's rights, but churches also have a say in it and have an opinion. And so I would encourage us as women especially to think really critically about women's rights and the voices that we're hearing in our culture today and whether they're actually promoting what's most beneficial for women or not. And just rather than jumping into one camp or the other or thinking about it as kind of this simple split between the church versus women, think about what women's rights actually are and what is best for us as women and engage in that conversation. Thank you.
Let's give Kate one more big round of applause. Thank you so much. You know, Kate, I just want to say, as a father of two daughters, that was particularly edifying for me, and I know for a lot of our dads and husbands in the room, thank you very much. Pastor Tim is here, and at this time, you guys have been texting in questions and tweeting those in, and so Pastor Tim is going to moderate, and we're going to go into our Q&A portion of the lecture. Thank you.
Okay, Kate. Let's start with a definitional question. Define misogyny.
Misogyny is the hatred of women.
Okay, that's all you want to say about that?
Pretty straightforward.
Did I answer your questions? Okay, so lots of different questions, and as you can imagine, kind of like all over the place. And so we'll take as many of these as we can, and the ones you feel good about answering, go for it, and the ones you don't, go for it, okay?
Okay.
So you talked about the view of the early church and kind of how they viewed women and handled women. Do you perceive that the honor attributed to Mary, Jesus' mother, was radical for that time?
I think that it was. I didn't speak about that very much, but in some of the reading that I was doing, that was something that came up again and again, that the veneration of female saints, and especially Mary, was very different for that time. And that also gave women, kind of as mothers and as nurturers, a higher status within Christian communities, especially Catholic communities in the early times.
Mm-hmm. Because Mary was a widow.
Mm-hmm.
So compare that to how widows around that time would have been treated in other cultures.
Mm-hmm. In other cultures, women would have been maybe burned, like the Indian practice of sati, or they would have been forced to remarry, or they would have been outcasts. I know in Islam, there's a practice that allows men to marry more than one woman, and one of the reasons that was given for that was because there were widows and women that weren't married that then weren't protected in society. And so men could marry more women in order to just kind of get them into marriage because not being married was bad. So it was hugely helpful to kind of have this veneration of widows that we need to take care of widows and that they're highly esteemed and not cast offs.
Mm-hmm. Another question about the early period, the whole idea of pagan women converting into the church. Do you perceive that as something that was difficult for pagan women to convert into the church, or do you see that was it easier to do that?
I don't know, to be honest, if it was difficult or easy, but from what I read, it was very, very appealing to women. They found solace in the Christian faith that they didn't find in the other faiths that were offered to them at that point. And I think that was largely because they were seen as having value, and they come into this faith and see that this God actually cares about them and they're worth something and they're made in the image of God. And so I don't know that there was, if it was easier for women as opposed to men to do that. But we do know that there were lots of women converting, more so than men in the early times.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question about the whole issue of monogamy. You see in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, and I know we're not talking about the Bible per se, but you do see polygamy taking place in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that in the early church. So can you reconcile at all, based on your study, of why you don't see that in the early church?
In the early church, when Paul talks about marriage, he talks about a man and a woman creating the marriage bond. And so from that, church fathers drew the conclusion that marriage, by definition, is between just two people rather than several people. And so I think that's why there was a change. I don't know why there was a change from the Old Testament to the New Testament. I'll leave that to you to answer.
Yeah, and Kate didn't really mention, I don't think you mentioned this, but if you weren't here on Sunday morning, if you go back and get the sermon from Sunday morning, I do walk through what does the Bible say about women, and spend a little bit of time in the early chapters of Genesis talking about what the Bible, the ideal was, and how the culture drifted away from that a bit too. So that raises one of the questions that was here, like how did the Plato-Aristotle dualism kind of come back into the church, since it really wasn't accepted in the first 300 years or so? Like it seemed like the church was doing really well with women, and then all of a sudden this dualism comes back in and you get all the stuff that went on after that.
I'm not sure why exactly, but I have an idea of why, I think. So I think that when Christianity first was born into the world, this was not a religion of philosophers and thinkers. These were people that were persecuted by the Roman Empire, and they were kind of, you know, band together and trying to make this work, and were often killed and trying to spread the religion and being martyred. As Christianity became institutionalized by Constantine and enjoyed more kind of freedom, people were able to think, academics were drawn to the religion, and then people inevitably started to try to synthesize it with the other philosophies that they were seeing at that time, much like we do today. We take our faith or our perspectives and look at what other people are saying and try to make them fit or not, and I think that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add to that too from my study. And let me also give a pitch for next week while I'm doing that. Next week we're going to be talking about the university, and Dr. Glenn Luckey's going to be here, and this guy's got a PhD in sociology, studied under one of the foremost thinkers in the United States on social change and how does a society make positive changes. So going to get a brilliant guy talking next week. But talking about the university, it's always interesting what happens in academia when you get beyond the utilitarian, like how does life work better and so forth. And every PhD has to get smaller and smaller into the minutiae. You start bringing up all kinds of interesting things. And by the 1100s, the university system was very well developed in the Catholic Church, and the philosophers and theologians began to study Plato and Aristotle in significant ways. And really, one of the most significant theologians of that period that kicked off the scholastic period, Thomas Aquinas, wrote his Summa, which is his big work. I was required to read it in seminary, his big work. And the whole purpose of that was to take Plato and the Bible and try to find a way to marry them together. And so you can see, in fact, I told you guys last week that we're here when we talked about the environment, that when Thomas Aquinas got it wrong about creation care, he wasn't quoting the Bible. He was quoting Aristotle. So the Protestant Reformation, even though they didn't immediately get it right on women's issues and start dealing with it, that return to the Bible was a corrective for where the institutional church was starting to go. And, you know, if you come from a Catholic background here, I'm not trying to slam on Catholics. I'm just simply saying that the church was there was a lot more philosophy and a lot more synthesis than there was what does the Bible say. And my personal opinion would be that that's where they really started getting off track on the women's issues. Okay?
Thank you.
You okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's another topic that actually you didn't talk really much about modern, like the modern stuff. You just made a mention of this, so you may or may not feel comfortable with this question or not, but the question is, what role did the church play in the women's suffrage movement?
That's a good question. And I don't know a lot about this, but as I was looking over it a little bit, I noticed that there were many prominent suffragettes that actually came from a Quaker background and were Christians and were quite religious and were also involved in the abolition movements. And so those two movements kind of came together, working for the rights of people that were seen to be inferior by most of the culture. So I think it did play a role.
Mm-hmm. In support of the Catholic Church, since I said something negative, a little bit negative. So I have this question. Who have been some of the church's women's theologians in history? Are there any women who have been declared a doctor of the church by the Roman Catholic Church?
Probably. I don't know. I feel that you know the answer to that.
Well, fortunately, the person who asked the question supplied the answer.
Oh.
So, Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, Teresa de, that's French, I can't say it, Lisieux, Hildegard of Bingen. So anyway, there's four right there. So somebody knows Catholic Church history, and awesome. Okay, let's see here. So given how the ancient culture treated women, was your first myth, the big myth, was it a more recent one? In other words, this myth that the church has always opposed women, and if not, is it an attempt at revisionist history? And if so, then when do you think you would date that thing coming about? The myth that the church has always opposed, is always viewed women as bad. And been anti-women.
I personally would probably date it around the time of the Enlightenment, because before the Enlightenment,
date the Enlightenment for everybody.
So the Enlightenment was about after the 1700s, so 18th, 19th centuries before modern times. So that's when all these thinkers like Hobbes and Locke talking about natural rights and some of the Darwinian thought was starting to come into play. And they were very vocal about the superstitious dark ages and religion was bad and people were steeped in that and didn't know what was going on and weren't rational. So I would imagine that that was probably when this kind of myth about the church, a lot of these myths actually that we've been talking about, started to become very common, that the church has always done this or that, and especially has always oppressed women. And at that stage, they did oppress women in the sense that women didn't have rights. Women only were allowed to vote about 100 years ago in our country, which is crazy. And we saw what the theological thinking was at that stage. But at the same time, the Enlightenment thinkers also didn't think very highly of them. But I think that they were very anti the church as an institution and would have propagated myths like that. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I totally agree. I think what you have going on there is the Enlightenment thinkers, in order to get, we talked about this quite a bit last couple weeks, the Enlightenment thinkers who, by the way, part of the reason why we talk about the Enlightenment thinkers here is because most of academia believes that the Enlightenment did everything that's positive in Western society, that the thinkers in the Enlightenment were the ones who saved the world from the superstition of religion. In fact, the leading skeptic in the United States, head of the Skeptic Society, somebody sent me a recent article that he wrote, and he basically said that the only reason why Christianity today is not killing people like ISIS is because they successfully came through the Enlightenment, and that's why they're not killing people, because that's their view of the whole history of the church. Even though historically we know that's not true, but that's what people today say looking back to the Enlightenment. But what we do know about the Enlightenment is the Enlightenment laid the groundwork for most of what took place in the 20th century. So as Kate mentioned, you know, fascism, communism, some real interesting twists like the Nazism and all that, those were experimental forms of government that came out of the Enlightenment thinkers. Also, I want to clarify, make sure we're on the same page here. When you say Darwinism, you talking about the science, or are you talking about the philosophy of what people did with the science?
The philosophy.
That's real important for everybody here. Did you guys get that? So when we're talking about Darwin, we're not throwing the idea that there was a process by which life came about, which was the theory that Darwin put forward. We're talking about what people did with that idea. If survival of the fittest, natural selection is really the way it works, then what does that say about lower forms of humanity? Does that make sense? Like inferior people.
And we've seen that Darwinian kind of theory was used as a tool of propaganda by many different people to promote their theory. So I had a quote about, you know, women's skulls are smaller and so they must be stupid compared to men, things like that. It was conveniently used and twisted to promote ideas like that.
Yeah. I also think that what's interesting is that as you talked about Plato, you clearly discussed like a concept of reincarnation. So the idea that reincarnation and all those ideas came from Hinduism is not really true. I mean, they were developing those ideas there, but they were also developing them that Plato believed in reincarnation and Aristotle believed in evolution. So Aristotle put forward the theory of evolution long before Darwin started working on a scientific way of supporting that. So the idea of life forms being less valuable, more valuable, less intelligent, more intelligent, actually started with Aristotle, and that's where the Enlightenment people went to get their information. So one of the questions that people want to know is, what is the position of Hill Country Bible Church on the role of women?
Oh, women are good. I think that's pretty much sums it up, right?
Okay, that's good. Excellent.
I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Well, it's a really interesting question, and the challenge is I think what you put forward before, when we start talking about women and women's rights and women's roles and women's values and women's capabilities and all that, that's not a monolithic statement or idea. Like, they're all different opinions on various forms of this question. And so, like, there are lots and lots of people that think the idea of abortion is exclusively about promoting women. And there are lots of people that believe that. But there are a lot of women who do not believe that abortion is morally right. So which woman is right about what's best for women? Particularly when half of the fetuses that are aborted are women. So is it a, you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's a little bit of a struggle to say that abortion is a, it's definitely a woman's issue. There's no question it's a woman's issue, but which one of the issues is pro-women and which one of the issues is anti, which one side is pro-women, which side is anti-women? That's something that requires a little bit more thought than just putting it all into one camp. So sexual liberation. And the question is, sexual liberation a healthy thing? Well, it depends on what you mean by sexual liberation. Does it mean that women ought to have the right to pursue a sex life? Or does it mean women ought to have the right to have as many partners as they want to? Or that women ought to have equal sexual expression within marriage? If I polled the room here, we'd get differences of opinion. So who says which one of those is actually a woman's, the side that's on the right side of womanhood? And I think that's why you were challenging us to, that we got to think more deeply about these issues rather than just lumping them into this generalization that you're either for or against women, and the radical arm of one group gets to define what that means, or the radical arm of the other group gets to define what that means. So I don't know if that's helpful or not. It's an important subject. Here's another question. Why is the historical process of change so slow? Like, if the Bible has clarity on this, why does it take so long for society and for the church and all that to move? Because, I mean, we clearly talked about a long runway.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think that's a very valid question. I don't know the answer, because when you look at the Bible and what it says about people and their value and how we should treat people, it's very clear. So why aren't we doing that? And why didn't people do that throughout history? I think that probably one of the reasons is that, as we know today, cultural and societal pressures are strong. And we, I think, find ourselves acting and living in ways that we would maybe say actually isn't what we think is maybe right or what Christianity teaches, but because of societal pressure, we think, well, it doesn't really matter, or, well, it's okay. Or society even makes us believe that something is right. So the issues that I've talked about, women in slavery, societies and cultures had reasons for why they thought that was good or valuable or okay, and people bought into it. And I think that's the nature of humans. We buy into things and we don't change, and it takes a long time and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to make a difference, which is sad.
So you were deeply embedded in the Muslim community when you were in London. And in our world over here, we think that asking women to wear the hijab or the burqa, like, every woman would hate that. So talk to that from your experience of interacting with Muslim women. We talk about this long progression of change, or people thinking that it's a good thing, even though it doesn't seem like it's a good thing.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out where you want me to go with it.
Well, I just talk about some of your friends and what they thought about things that in the U.S. we think are oppressive to women in relationship to dress.
Okay. I think that's an interesting topic, because a lot of people that are kind of outside of cultures will have an idea about what something means in a religion or a culture that's different from what another culture thinks. So some of my friends that do wear hijab believe it to be extremely liberating, that it liberates them from having to think about their bodies in relationship to society and how they should look. It liberates them from men looking at them or treating them in a certain way, and it's also an act act of piety by covering up and wearing hijab. They are kind of saying to God, I'm not looking at myself and I'm not looking for attention. I'm kind of giving that up to you in a culture that highly values how women look. And so from that perspective, it could be a really positive thing. And as I got to know different people that had that perspective, I started to think, if Christianity said I had to wear a hijab, would I do that? Like, I wouldn't want to do that. And kind of felt convicted that if I thought that God wanted me to do that, I really wouldn't want to. And so it's depending on kind of what culture you're in and why you do things and all of that, you'll have reasons that might be positive for doing something, whereas outside of that, you see it negatively. I don't know if that's what you want me to say.
Yeah. So could that? I'm asking for an example. Is that an example of why sometimes it takes a really long time, generations, for changes to take place?
Right.
Because at some point in time, somebody breaks out and says, "I'm not going to wear this anymore," and then other people.
And that person might have felt that it was oppressive, whereas many other people didn't feel that way.
Right. Right. Yeah. In fact, I couldn't help it. So I'm reading some of this literature along the way. Some of the biggest people against women's suffrage, the right to vote, were women. Which is, you know, we have a tendency to think that all the ideas, like there's a men versus women world, and men are always against women and women are always for each other. But like we saw in the witch hunts and what we saw like in women's suffrage, there were many outspoken women that were against women getting the right to vote. And I don't know. It's very interesting. So, yeah, I know we're going to cut this off here, but what would you say to Christian men? And I know everybody here that's not a Christian, but the people who would consider themselves Christian, what would you say to Christian men about how they could help us move along in the way women are treated today? Brian Irvin's sitting right there. Here's your shot.
I think... I'm trying to choose my words carefully. I think kind of going back to what we were talking about in terms of women's rights and how there are different perspectives on that, it's difficult to say all men should view women this way or that way. I think that I'll speak personally. I think there's definitely a feeling that I have in our culture that it's very positive for and powerful for women to be very promiscuous and sexually liberated, and that men also view women that way and are supposed to support that. And I think that it would be helpful for Christian men to be critical in their thinking about where they're participating in that conversation and supporting it, whether knowingly or not, and maybe take a step back from that and maybe be a little bit more critical of the messages that we participate in and listen to, whether they're coming on the radio or on TV or in magazines or whatever. I think that we as women and as men have a constant back and forth where we're promoting something and then we're criticizing it, but then we're also engaging in it again. And I'm kind of, I guess, bringing it back to women and men on this topic, but I think that we need to think about it, take a step back and think about it more and see where we're supporting it and not. Does that make sense?
So yeah, this is interesting. So as a young woman, would you say that men could clean up their act a little bit about how they interact with women?
Yeah.
Yep. We've had this conversation a few times. So, final comment. The advantage of a father-daughter conversation here. Kate comes home from the gym one day, and she says, I just get sick of men looking at me when I'm working out. Like, I went in there to work out. I get sick of men looking at me. All these old men are looking at me. And I said, like, maybe they're just trying to look at the TV and you happen to keep walking in front of them. She said, no. She said, when I'm over here on this weight machine and he's looking at me, and then I'm over here doing this, and he's like, and then I'm over here. she said, I just get sick of it. I said, so are you telling me like you've got 50 and 60-year-old guys that are on the treadmill that are watching you walk around? And she said, no, I'm talking about like 35-year-old men. And I thought to myself, okay, so I think of myself at 55 as being an old man, but 35-year-old guys to a 22-year-old girl, you guys are old men too. So quit looking at my daughter when she's working out in the gym. Because you're not as hot as you think you are.
I don't know how we could end on better wisdom than that. Thank you guys very much. Hey, at this time, I really want to thank you guys out at Steiner Ranch and Brushy Creek. We're going to cut you guys, cut the feed, and you're going to get some closing communication from your campus pastors.